It just reminds me over and over again that although our experiences are unique, the experience of our emotions are not unique. And that's what allows us to sort of cross that barrier of when something seems untranslatable. That's where I find stories so compelling and art so effective. And Chung is interesting because Chung is a little newer, but I'm working deeper and deeper into this beautiful word, which is very similar to Han, but it's the other end of Han. It's a love, it's a bond, it's an attachment, and it can be for anything. So there's a sort of it can be geopolitical, it can be attachment to earth, word, nature, the relationship things have, the country, you know. It can just be deeply personal, like they say you're born of your mother's chung, you know, that chung is the thing that gives birth to you, it's her chung. And so yeah, I love that word, and for the same reasons in a similar way, and the impact and relationship it has with Han. And so as I study more about Han, the more I get closer to knowing Chung, because these two opposing things seem to define each other by what they are and what they're not. Mm-hmm. So that's been great. It's something I also talk about a lot when I speak to Korean literature and Korean American literature, is sometimes we'll look at certain scenes or look at the way the book moves, and I think if we add the discussion of Han and Chung to it, it'll really open up the history of what's being talked about much more, and talk about the language on another level, because I do think Han and Chung could be new ways to think about literature here, and that goes for any piece of literature now, and the way we can discuss device, and
So I became very curious about Han. Coincidentally, I was reading your work in a book by Mary Kim Arnold called Litany for the Long Moment that also talked about Han at the same time, which prompted me to look further into it, finding a pamphlet edited by Janice Lee called Inherited Trauma, where she invited four different Korean writers to write on Han. And I was hoping I could just read a couple little pieces that struck me and just hear how they struck you.
That would be great. Thank you.
Okay. So in the intro from Janice, there's a quote from Sun Nam Dong that describes Han as a feeling of unresolved resentment against injustices suffered, a sense of helplessness because of the overwhelming odds against one, a feeling of acute pain in one's guts and bowels, making the whole body writhe and squirm, and an obstinate urge to take revenge and to right the wrong, all of these combined. And then later it says, Han is more than the presence of historical trauma, though the Japanese occupation of Korea and later the division of the peninsula seem important to Han. Han also weaves together unresolved corporeal history and the impossibility of articulation or expression. And this last part made me think of both of how the correspondence between you and your mother was one way that you were receiving letters but were not able to write them back in the same fashion, and that you literally couldn't read them. But the part that leapt out the most to me was a line from the chapter by Soo-yeon Juliet Lee, where she describes Han and says, catalog all the things you can never know. Now paint them in your dreams with blood. And she goes on to describe post-Hemery Han as a type of time travel or mind reading or speculative intelligence. And I guess I wondered if any or all of these things produce thoughts for you or feelings, or
yes,
things that you want to push back against or embrace.
No, I think with my work in Han, all of those things are true. I think it's really helpful. Have you heard of table setting? I love using this. I learned it for when I'm trying to have sort of difficult discussions on certain issues, table setting is so helpful because it helps us visualize that. It's almost like I'll put one definition of Han on a table, and when I add another one, it doesn't take off the first one. It's just that they can be there together. And so you keep sort of table setting and adding all these things and never taking any one of them off. And what that allows is sort of like your spirit around this word to encompass all these things simultaneously for a better understanding of what Han is. And I think Han does seem to ring, have slight nuances depending on the field of research. And I think that's very interesting. Like in psychology, they definitely talk about the physical symptoms of Han, including dizziness, heart palpitations. I mean, these are very, fainting, going to the hospital. These are very real. And there's also Han spoken of in sort of the political spheres and all the sort of change that's going on in South Korea now as a spirit of revolution, as something that allows you to enact. I think you mentioned the word revenge, but it also can be this sort of righteousness of wanting exactitude. And I think it's that as well. The deep historical trauma is true, but I think we think of the deep historical roots of Han as still pretty recent. But I mean, I think it goes way back. You know, it goes back to the way women are treated in old Korean society, and there's old traditions where let's say if your husband dies, you have to bury yourself with him in the tomb. And that brings sort of honor to your family, and that allows your family the rest of your family to continue living with their head held high. I mean, that causes a sort of deeply painful Han. I think it's still a work in progress, but I'm seeing more and more how Han is passed, the way Han is passed down through women, the way those stories of Han are told and reinforced as well. Not necessarily relieved, but sometimes exacerbated with the relationship of mother-in-laws and with new wives coming into the family and the debt that is immediately owed. So that creates a sort of devastating Han. I know that my mother and my father's mother, my grandmother, they didn't have the best relationship. There's this painful Han between them. I find all of that so fascinating and interesting. And for me, the way that I am translating Han now is one more like tiny little facet to that kaleidoscopic word. And that's, I see Han as a sort of gap. It's a gap between two things, and it can be any two things. You know, it can be resolve and not being resolved, or some sort of recompense, or some sort of healing. But it's the gap that won't close. And it's a gap that you yourself sometimes won't close, because the risk is if you close that gap, if you heal, if you move on, if you forgive, if you try to move in that direction, it almost feels as if you cannot have Han anymore when you've identified yourself with Han for so long. And so Han, I think, also includes a resistance to lose Han. Mm.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
And if I were to do my own table setting in order to find another entryway into your book and your experience with your mother and her letters, that quote that I read by Suyun Juliet Lee, catalog all the things you can never know, now paint them in your dreams with blood, made me think of something that you said about your mother's letters. You said, I don't see these translations as complete. If her letters can go to sleep, my translations are their dreams. Which is just, I think, such a fantastic way to look at it.
Well, I didn't read the complete piece by Suyun, but it's very interesting because it makes me visually think of the Red Room, and the Red Room is a sort of saying in Korean families. It's a room that's full of your family secrets, and that room is sort of passed down from generation to generation, and sort of seeing the walls covered in the blood written of the things you cannot know. Well, the most interesting thing I've discovered is sort of whether you know these things or not, whether you know your history or not, it doesn't mean that those things don't continue to hurt you and pain you. The only thing is you just don't have a name for it, and you don't know the reason or cause, and you don't have a great trace to find out what it is for yourself. So it's quite damaging, actually, I think. But it's interesting because I think it also is rooted in a sort of survival and protection. When I talk about how my translations are the dreams, if my mother's letters were to go to sleep, I think it's to say that the translations aren't my mother's letters, and I think that differentiation is important. It's not the actual object of my mother's letters, it's just one way and one interpretation. It's just a reflection of them, and that feels very important because I do think I make choices in my translations, choices like I want the English to sound very Korean, so things like rhythm and syntax. Some of the words might seem like odd choices, but they feel much more fitting for me. And so the letters, even if they're in English, should read in a way that you hear the Korean behind them, rather than feeling as if the Korean is completely erased and you're just reading the English. And so my letters are sort of dreaming and full of these little choices and interpretations. They try to mirror the letters, but they're not. And so I really encourage people to look at my mother's original letters for themselves and look at the English, look at the handwriting and everything else.
So I was hoping maybe we could have you read an excerpt about visiting your mother, and then if you don't mind, a half page much later about you and your mother as well. And perhaps it's important to mention that there develops sort of a class issue between your reality in America and your parents' reality in Korea. They are living a life of relative luxury in Korea, and you're living with your brother who's just gone off to college, and things aren't so luxurious in the United States for you.
I'd love to. The world opened to pure white ceilings and rooms. The east wall of her living room was a tremendous sheet of glass overlooking the city. Her kitchen had foldable cupboards, like origami, springing open then shutting flush against the boards. One unfolded 5 feet to reveal a cubby with gifts of wine and pears, then concealed itself again. Another contained a circular microwave. "I couldn't wait for you to see all of our new stuff," she said, flashing 2 car keys, as if she had gotten them yesterday, and credit cards gifted by the company for the department store with its green rooftop that was visible from where we stood. "Your brother called me," she pouted and dropped her head. "I baby treat him too much. I have to stop nagging him and let him go. I have to change my thinking." He had visited her before, but after once or twice, he stopped. "He was too busy to come," I answered. "Oh," she said, "I've been buying this and that, collecting souvenirs. Look at these tiny spoons. I have this rabbit and I call her Eunji." She held up a stuffed doll by the ears and showed it to me. "Sometimes she doesn't listen to me. I keep her in your room." "You keep it in my room?" "It's across the hall." Looking inside, I saw socks flipped at the ankles on the nightstand, as if the night before I might have thrown them to the floor. Cleaning, she would have picked them up. She frowned. When I miss you, I lie on this bed until your dad gets home. When does he get home? Maybe 11, she said. Your poor dad hates working in this country. It was as we stood over my bed, its flowered bedsheets and department store blankets, that she asked me if I needed her to come back, knowing that they had already signed on to stay for another 2 years, that my father's contract had been extended owing to his good work. I did not know why she asked. Her words had not yet settled when she reassured me that by the time she came back, I would have forgotten how I missed her. You tell the kind and patient person, she said, to be more kind and patient. That's why my NG will live the hardest life. My mother fussed over my clothes. Sniffing, she told me to throw them off because they were rotten. Then she cursed my patchy skin. Of course I was sick so often. After a scrub at the bathhouse, she said quickly, cradling my head against her shoulder, my dead layers would fall away to show the smooth and clean boiled egg texture underneath. A few weeks with me, she said, and you'll look and feel differently than you do now. Next one's on 81. I was my mother's daughter, the same face except for subtle differences one would notice on close study. Though her lips were fuller, my eyes were wider. Her brows framed her face gently, while mine bordered my face like a box. I shaved the arches of my eyebrows to soften them like hers. I looked like my mother like her mother, but no one would say I looked like my mother's mother. My mother drank heavily after her mother's death. My father, her friend then, dragged her out of bars regularly. But one night a man tossed a remark at her. Right there, my father brawled with him and nearly died when the man broke a beer bottle and stabbed my father in the throat, barely missing the jugular. The man had two friends with him. Both joined in the beating of my father. My mother called her brothers to rescue him. After that day, they got married. I was my father's daughter because there was in me, other than my face, this love for my mother.
Been listening to E.J. Coe read from The Magical Language of Others. One of the things that you do in this book is travel upstream through generations of intergenerational trauma or Han, if not to find the cause, to sort of create more context for how it works in your family or to do some table setting, as you'd say. But before we talk about what you explore and what you discover as you do this, I wanted to hear more about you saying that there is death in the Korean language, because that statement reminds me of something Janice Lee said, that the Korean alphabet is conceived out of violence and trauma, embroiled in injustice. And I wanted to hear, before we continue, how death is in the Korean language in your mind.
Death being in the Korean language is so interesting. I agree with Janice and about the alphabet, the Korean alphabet, having and containing so much violence. I think one of the things I've learned as a translator that has been valuable to me and gave me a new perspective is how it's not only me translating from one language to another, but these languages are in and of themselves almost like their own, they have their own histories, and they have their own relationships with each other. And something that's really interesting is that there are, and this is something that can be felt, is there are dominant languages and there are non-dominant languages. And Korean, being a sort of language that through history has been non-dominant next to the English, you know, it really asks the question of whether translation is political, and I think it's inescapably political because of the language's histories. And so there's a choice that you make as a translator, and it's similar to the choice I made with my mother's letters, is having the Korean come forward rather than remain behind and allow its sort of history and death and wounding to show itself, because I think that's a step toward Chong rather than Han.
So when you go back in your family tree as part of this process, we follow you as you travel up the family tree, and we discover that one of your grandmothers for a time left her family. But we also see how personal traumas in your family really intersect with historical traumas on the paternal side of your family. A story where your paternal grandmother didn't learn that she was Korean until she was an adult. So I was hoping maybe you could talk about that side of the family, the ways Japanese occupation and the massacres that happened in the 20s and 40s have shaped the trajectory of your family and complicated questions of national identity as well.
Yes. So I begin the story with my grandmother's parents, because that's really when South Korea was colonized or annexed by Japan, and then you have that sort of colonial violence and your own sort of language and name taken away amongst other really horrifying atrocities. And so they escaped to, I believe it was Shinjuku, Japan. It's a city in Tokyo, or it's one of the little enclaves in Tokyo. And that's where my grandmother was born. And she was born with a different name. She was born with a Japanese name. And they lived there as Japanese people, sort of hiding in plain sight. And it was the way that many Korean people lived to survive, was they would escape to Japan, which was seemed like their only choice at the time. So that meant my grandmother sort of was born and raised in Tokyo with the belief that she was Japanese until she was 19. And I believe when she was 19, things were getting really bad over there. And so her mother and father told her the truth, you know. And it's very interesting because my grandmother would have been born and raised amid all this propaganda against Koreans and sort of these cultural violences. And so for her to learn that, I go into what that experience must have been for her. And they had to escape once again immediately to Jeju Island. So they went back to Jeju Island. And that's a really incredible point in history that we don't get to hear too often. It's when she went there, and then you have my grandmother's mother and father sort of reacquainting themselves with not only the Korean language but with the islanders of Jeju Island, who are different from mainland Korea. And I do want to clarify that they were familiar with Jeju Island, that they had been there before, but it had been such a long time. And for my grandmother, it was her first time. And getting used to this sort of matriarchal society there, and the culture of henyo and the sea women, and what it must have all been like for her. But one of the main scenes in the memoir have to do with the Jeju Island massacre. And that was this horrible atrocity that is maybe in this space, it seems not enough words I can say to really encompass what was going on. But there was this, it was backed by the U.S., so it was a campaign of sort of South Korean police officers that came onto the island of Jeju Island in fear of communists or sort of spies from as we are getting closer and closer to the divide of North and South. And so as a way of kind of clearing the island, that's exactly what happened. And so it wasn't just the South Korean police, and there were also like a really intense youth groups. And then other groups that were more left and more right. And so it was several things going on that caused, and all the revenge and pain. So over I think people usually associate it as one day, but it was over several months that that this massacre is happening. And I think it's really interesting to tell that story of what happened to my grandmother's father and how he was stoned to death and on the way of to retrieve some of their family or neighbors to make sure that they were safe, and sort of the way Kumiko found out, my grandmother found out about that. I think it was important to be there. Yeah.
Well, you do in the middle of this book, much like you do in your poetry collection, the middle of that collection being called War, you recount this telling of your great-grandfather's death by stoning. And you've also said that your mother's heroines were Korean women who threw themselves into fires, jumped off cliffs, and withstood torture. But you just also hinted at the positive associations you carry with the island as well. The henyo, the women divers, and you've connected that to your writing practice. And I was hoping maybe you could evoke for us the other side of the islands, the yeah. islands pre-massacre and
right.
Occupation, and what about that lineage? Because I read that your last name suggests that your family is potentially connected to the founding families
yes.
of the islands.
Yes.
Tell us about what you carry that's inspiring
yes.
about the henyo and the islands in general.
Yes. It's so interesting. Even recently, anytime I sort of visit another country or I visit an island, I fall in love. I feel like there's something in me that loves islands and I love the water so much. So anytime I get a chance, I try to be near water. And where I live now in West Seattle, I'm right along the edge of this peninsula that has this sort of feeling of being on an island. It's the Jeju. So the three founding families of Jeju Island are Ko, Pu, and Yang. And Ko being sort of our family name. It's really special to have that in us. So we still have some family there today. And I visited before, and I think I'll be visiting very soon this year again. And some of the lovely, the way the society runs in this, had this beautiful matriarchal way of living. It's so, so different from what we imagine as traditional Korean culture. And I think it's that contrast that can be really surprising when people find out about that and how these women divers, the henyo, would dive deep under into these sort of terrifyingly cold and dangerous waters and bring up these bounties that helped the island and the community, not only with the economy but with the social spheres and to help the island flourish in these ways. And so, you know, just a few of the wonderful things I talk about from the island are sort of the horses that are native to Jeju Island and the really large, beautiful fields of canola flowers, which are these bright, bright, bright yellow flowers that just bloom, and they bloom in such like large, like mountainous hillsides that cover the island in these beautiful tracks. So. And you get these very, very long caves and then the contrast of the sort of the dark rocky beaches. It's a really special thing that I feel deep in my bones, a sort of affection and connection to, where I feel grounded and closer to the earth. Yeah.
It was great having you on Between the Covers today, EJ.
Thank you so much. It was an incredible interview and a conversation.
We're talking today to poet and writer EJ Ko about her latest book, The Magical Language of Others, from Tin House Books. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
And you're tuned to Community Radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River, 104.3 FM Philomath and the Willamette Valley, on the web at kboo.fm.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
In 2016, evangelicals, Christians helped us, and they went out. Evangelical Christians went out, and they worked so hard, and they produced numbers like they've never produced before.
President Donald Trump, at an Evangelicals for Trump rally at a majority Latino evangelical megachurch in South Florida, Ministerio Internacional El Rey Jesus, or King Jesus Ministry. Today's National Religious Freedom Day, and religion plays a role in presidential elections. Political science professor Justin Crow says Republicans have largely been successful at mobilizing voters by talking up the political importance of Supreme Court nominees.
If you're speaking, say, to an evangelical audience, and obviously evangelicals are a core Republican constituency, you talk about Roe v. Wade and the Obama